Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered. We're trying to intelligently answer so many of the fabrications and falsehoods that were stated as accurate history and very well-researched facts that were brought to light under so many circumstances and presented by the Da Vinci Code. My guest, as usual, is Ron Elder, professor of church history, religion, and of course also government now at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar in Terre Haute, Indiana. Ron, welcome once again, and this is our 12th series where we've been trying to reply in detail to show that the Da Vinci Code, which claims, even on the front page of the novel, to be based on accurate, wonderful, impeccable research, and that in so many places it's just complete fabrication, made up, and has no historical basis. It's really a rewriting of history. And many people say, of course, well, it's just a novel, but because it claims to be based on such accurate history, it uses real names of people from history and then changes the whole traditional understanding historically of what we do know for sure about these people, particularly about Jesus and Mary Magdalene and the church, of course, through the 2,000 years of its history. So we've been talking especially about the sacred feminine, and that it's been a strong presentation in our, at the end of the last century, and of course our century now. Would we say why the sacred feminine is being presented so much as a counter-cultural to the ancient teachings of the four Gospels and the constant teaching of the Church?
Well, this is a major theme, of course, of the Da Vinci Code. If you don't understand, you know, this idea of the sacred feminine, then you really can't understand what Dan Brown is trying to do, you know, in the novel, the Da Vinci Code. What we had been doing is taking a look at a book by the name of Goddess Unmasked, written by a man by the name of Philip Davis, who's a professor of history at, I believe, at Penn State University. And what he does in the book, and at least in one or two of the chapters of the book, he describes this goddess myth. And the goddess myth essentially is the idea that there was a time, a very pristine past, where people who were basically Stone Age people, lived in you know, small villages, farmers, mostly farmed, and maybe did some gathering, things like that, you know, for their livelihoods, hunting, things of that sort. And according to the goddess myth, these people were, the sacred feminine was very important in their religion, the goddess, particularly goddess worship. And supposedly these were people who didn't understand the real role that men played in the generation of children, at least according to the goddess myth, that a lot of radical feminists and even some scholars, you know, get into this kind of thing. And this is the way that basically most of these societies that stretched all the way from England, or what came to be England much later on, Britain, perhaps all the way to China, and from Northern Europe all the way down to, let's say, Northern Africa. And almost all these people basically worship a goddess.
This led them to a tranquility and peace and harmony that was lost when the sacred feminine was lost in a society.
Well, how it was lost, and that's a very important part of the story, was that there were also other peoples, Semitic peoples, Indo-European peoples, who were herdsmen. And these herdsmen were people who, you know, who herded sheep and goats and cattle and things of that sort. And I wish the Jewish people, of course, were part of the Semitic peoples and the Arabic peoples and many other peoples. And these people moved around all the time. And because they moved around, they didn't get attached to the land or to the soil very well. So they didn't really have a lot of concern, supposedly, for ecology and the Mother Earth, the idea of Mother Earth, you know, which was so important to goddess worship and the sacred feminine and what have you. So not only that, but these herdsmen knew all about the role that men played in the generation of children. And so it was because of that reason, because of that knowledge they had, that they that the men become dominant rather than women in matriarchy, like you found in the more Stone Age peoples who were settled in you know, villages and who were farmers and herdsmen, or farmers, I mean, not herdsmen. These Semitic and Indo-European peoples being herdsmen and understanding more about how children were, that the role that men played, that these societies become more and more patrilocal and patrilineal and patriarchal. In other words, the men rule. And so the gods become male gods rather than feminine gods and sacred.
And war and conflict and conquering become just a natural part of society.
Yes.
Now, I think the next question, Ron, is what is the evidence to be found in this claim that these goddess societies who lived in peace and tranquility before men and the patriarchy idea took over, what's the evidence from scholars that this type of society and civilizations actually existed?
Well, we briefly touched on this the last time. Feminist scholars and other writers cite archaeological discoveries at Crete and Malta and prehistoric Britain, places in Turkey and the Balkans and elsewhere as evidence of the existence of goddess societies and cultures in the ancient world. In other words, that story that we just repeated a little bit and described about the goddess myth, that wherever the Indo-Europeans and the Semites went, they destroyed the sacred feminine and goddess worship and replaced it with patriarchy and God the Father. Now, we don't have time to go into the claims, but competent anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians have decisively refuted the claims that goddess societies ever existed. You would have to read Philip Davis's book where he, you know, he presents a lot of that evidence that refutes this.
But so he's saying the goddess societies never existed.
That they never existed.
Okay.
That after carefully evaluating the evidence presented by feminist scholars for the existence of goddess worship in these societies, Davis asserts, quote, "Not a single one of these sites provides clear evidence of a single supreme female deity. Not a single one exhibits the signs of matriarchal rule," or that is, rule of the woman or rule of the mother, "or even of serious political power sharing between the sexes. Not a single one displays with any surety the enlightened attitude towards social egalitarianism,
being equal,
nonviolent interpersonal and interstate relations, and ecological sensitivity, which we have been led to anticipate." That is, in the goddess myth. "In each of these cases, the story of the goddess is a fabrication and defiance of the facts," end of quote. And I think what's really happened is that feminists have rewritten history to confirm or to conform to their own ideological preconceptions. In this regard, Davis quotes the French feminist Monique Wittig, quote, "Remember, make an effort to remember. Or failing that, invent," end of quote. In other words, just make it up if you can't find the facts.
Okay.
Now, this represents the view of reality and the truth held by most radical or social radicals, including many, many radical feminist writers, that there exists no objective truth outside of our minds. Therefore, one is justified in constructing reality in accordance with his or her own opinions. And, of course, this is just nothing but pure subjectivity. And I think it's easy to see how Dan Brown appears to buy into this
mentality.
And this goddess myth in the Da Vinci Code. And his critics claim he has in mind the alternatives of replacing God the Father with the sacred feminine and goddess. And to him and his radical feminist allies, replacing God the Father with a feminine deity is the solution to curing the social and environmental ills of our times, including war and ecological destruction and all such kinds of things.
Okay, so it's a strongly driven social attempt to better the world by, if necessary, make up some things about goddess worship. But we've got to get rid of the real problem, which is the losing of the sacred feminine.
Well, their motives are good.
Okay.
But the means with which they choose to do so, I think, are not good.
But that
goes back to the old idea, you know, that there's a tendency amongst liberals to believe that the ends justify the means. In other words, the ends of the glorious heaven on earth we're going to create here, that almost any means to getting there is okay.
Okay, because there is no objective reality. There aren't any real facts that history passes down to us. So we are all just trying to, the opposite of Christianity, the truth will make you free. So we're trying to discover the truth we can just be creative and say, here's a solution to our problems, and here's how history proves that it's a solution to our problems.
Yes, the radical would hold that there's no truth outside the mind, so basically you just construct your own truth based on your own ideology or your own desires.
So we're back again to Pope Benedict the 16th famous statement made early in his pontificate, that the great fundamental foundational problem of the world today is the dictatorship of relativity, or there isn't any revealed truth. There's no even revealed historical truth. I don't mean revealed, but I mean attainable historical truth. That truth is what you make it, or I make it, or anybody else makes it.
That's how the Da Vinci Code ends, actually. The book and the movie. Dan Brown, through Robert Langdon, tells Sophie, the heroine, of the story that, you know, well, all of this stuff that we've discovered doesn't really matter. Well, all that really matters, Sophie, is what you believe.
Okay.
That's ultimate reality, as far as you're concerned.
Right. All right. Well, it's a good summary there. What about Dan Brown's claim in the Da Vinci Code that all pagans celebrated the sacred feminine? And of course, there's his great attack that the Catholic Church stamped this out, this idea of the sacred feminine.
Well, Dan Brown's critics have said that one of his main goals in the Da Vinci Code is to sow the seeds of doubt regarding the truth of Christianity and to glorify paganism so it can replace Christianity. In other words, bring the goddess myth back and make it a reality. Because they believe, I think genuinely, that this is going to bring us peace and prosperity and all kinds of good things. According to Mark Shea and Edward Shree in The Da Vinci Deception, Brown discussed this issue in a television interview in which he said that, quote, "In the early days, we lived in a world of gods and goddesses. Every Mars had an Athena. The god of war had the goddess of beauty. In the Egyptian tradition, Osiris and Isis. And now we live in a world solely of gods. The female counterpart has been erased." And this was reported in a CNN interview that he had given at one time or another.
Well, now, there were certain gods and goddesses in ancient times, right?
Yes.
Okay. But the problem is that he overstated the complexity of it.
Yes,
and I mean the simplicity of it,
and overstated the role that female goddesses played in the ancient world. Going on with Shea and Shri, they explained that although goddess worship was prevalent in the ancient world, it certainly wasn't universal. It's true that some pagans did worship goddesses, but others worshiped no gods at all and regarded belief in gods as ignorant superstition. Moreover, some pagans worshiped one god, while others honored a huge pantheon or whole group of gods. And they go on to say that some didn't distinguish between earthly creatures and gods, while others clearly understood that earthly creatures were merely representations of spiritual realities. Also, they tell us that some pagans were philosophers who looked at gods as abstractions. This is particularly true of some of the ancient Greek philosophers.
Okay.
While others practiced mystery cults devoted solely to masculine deities, or in some cases feminine deities, in some cases animal totems. And some believed in magic, while others believed in science, and many in both. They concluded, in other words, they're trying to make a point here, they concluded by saying, quote, in short, all pagans had only one thing in common. They were not Christians or Jews. The notion that worship of the sacred feminine was universally practiced throughout the pre-Christian paganism is simply false.
Okay, so this is Shea and Shri, who have made it a firm study of this, and just come up with the conclusion that pre-Christian paganism was everywhere is just not factual.
It's interesting. Shri, he teaches at Benedictine College. I think that's where he teaches out in Kansas. And my daughter lives in that area, and she's met him on several occasions, if I recall right. I've seen him on a video. I've never actually personally met the man, but he's very impressive, and especially when he deals with this subject on the Da Vinci Code.
And, of course, I think I misstated what I was trying to say there. He was saying, or they were saying, that the sacred feminine, which the scholars that back the Da Vinci Code want to say, he just says it's just absolutely false that this was practiced throughout all Christian paganism.
And that's the point, of course, that they're trying to make and to refute, you know, Dan Brown's claim in that regard.
Sure.
In fact, Brown argues through his characters in the Da Vinci Code that Christianity stamped out the sacred feminine and replaced the true goddess with an all-male god. Masculinity is associated with aggression and war, whereas femininity is affiliated with meekness and peace. His proposed solution, that is Dan Brown's proposed solution, is to reintroduce goddess worship into our culture, into our society. And he claims that this is what Jesus had intended to do when he married Mary Magdalene and entrusted the church to her instead of Peter, which we'll come to that later and refute that later.
But one of the outlandish claims that the book makes,
yes,
that this is supposedly historically researched and can be easily demonstrated, that Jesus married Mary Magdalene and he really wanted her to be the first pope, not Peter.
Well, according to Brown,
right,
the Acexist apostles took over the church after Jesus died, suppressed the role of Mary and
Mary Magdalene,
and established an all-male hierarchy under the leadership of Peter. And then 3 centuries later, when Constantine became the emperor, as we've already refuted this, but he raised Jesus to divine status at the Council of Nicaea in order to make the church more powerful and use it as an instrument for better controlling his subjects. But as I said,
we went into great detail about the Council of Nicaea and about Constantine. And again, the problem seems to be the book uses real historical names, such as Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, 313, gave freedom of practice to the Christians, first time for 300 years, and that the Council of Nicaea actually existed, but it didn't really say the things that the book says that the Council of Nicaea, and that's what we discussed before,
yes,
really determined. Okay, now we're getting into a little tricky language here. Neo-Gnostic myth, the new Gnostic fabrication of the feminist early church. And the big question often comes up, Ron, is what about the claim that Jesus was really a radical feminist? That he didn't follow all the rules. He talked to women, the woman at the well, and he had women followers who helped him in great ways. He obviously was very close to Mary Magdalene and to Mary and Martha, who were two of his best friends, along with Lazarus, their brother. Jesus really wasn't held down or bound by many of the rules of Jewish culture at the time.
Well, certainly Jesus did show, women a lot of respect. Philip Jenkins states in the Hidden Gospels, this is another book we've quoted on several occasions, subtitled How the Search for Jesus Lost Its Way. Actually, he's the professor I misstated a while ago. Davis doesn't teach at Penn State. It's this Jenkins who teaches at Penn State.
Okay.
But nonetheless, he says, quote, late 19th century activists saw Jesus and his first followers as proto-feminist.
Meaning as the first feminist.
The first feminist, right.
Okay.
Whose radical ideas were swamped by a patriarchal orthodoxy, end of quote.
They got drowned out.
Yes.
Okay.
In addition to feminist, he says that, quote, the idea that the Gnostics retained the core truths of lost Christianity was commonplace among occult and esoteric writers, many of whom shared the contemporary excitement over women's suffrage and other progressive causes, end of quote. Carl Olson, this is another man we've quoted on quite a few occasions, he says that feminist and occult writers used heretical Gnostic forms of early Christianity for material to bolster their belief that Jesus was really a radical feminist. I'm quoting him here. The church was initially founded as an egalitarian and non-dogmatic body, and women were among the first apostles, or were, as in the case of Mary Magdalene, the primary apostle, end of quote. Now, Olson goes on to tell us that one of the first Gnostic texts effectively used by feminists was called the Pistis Sophia, that is, the Books of the Savior, which was published in English in 1896. And in it, Mary Magdalene is portrayed as Jesus' foremost apostle, frustrating the male disciples because Jesus gave them so little attention. You see, these ideas, what we're trying to do is show here, these ideas were around quite a few years, even back in the 19th century, these ideas that Dan Brown is picking up, his sources, or he himself is picking up and putting into this novel.
Okay, so they were always already being written about in the late 1800s.
Yes, and then in the 1900s especially. However, he says that the Nag Hammadi discovery of over 60 Gnostic texts in 1945 provided even more ammunition for those looking to undermine church authority and change the structures and theology of the Catholic Church. Now, that figure of 60 there, I was watching a program last night, a two-hour program on the National Geographic Channel on the Gospel of Judas, which we'll have occasion to mention here a little bit later on in the later session. In this particular program, they said that there were only 30. But I think looking at the Nag Hammadi has a website, and I'm almost sure, looking at that website, they said a little over 50. So,
okay,
at least 50 of these, I think.
And these were certainly wonderful discoveries in Egypt about ancient documents that had never actually been. They knew of them from the early church fathers' writings about them, but they didn't have the copies of them.
Yes,
and these Gnostic Gospels.
What we knew about them, as you said, the church fathers such as St. Irenaeus had copied out extensive quotations to refute them. And that's all we had. For example, the Gospel of Judas. All we had is what St. Irenaeus of Lyon had written.
And Irenaeus was in what?
Second century, 180s.
Okay.
But then they did find a Gospel of Judas, and somewhere in probably the late 40s, maybe the late 40s, the early 50s, something of that sort.
And that was a Gnostic gospel.
It was a Gnostic gospel.
Or what the church has always considered to be a fabricated gospel. That's certainly different from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
And we're going to explain these Gnostic gospels soon. Maybe not in this session, but in the coming session. But nonetheless, Jenkins quotes Elaine Pagels, who did more than anyone else to popularize the discovery in her book, The Gnostic Gospels, this saying, quote, "The Nag Hammadi sources discovered at the time of contemporary social crisis concerning sexual roles challenge us to interpret history, reinterpret history, and to reevaluate the present situation." In fact, it's interesting. She was the main scholar that they were consulting with last night on this program on the Gospel of Judas. She was on there at least 15, 20 times in that 2-hour
She's considered to be a really high-class scholar.
Yeah, she's a professor of theology at Princeton University or Princeton Theological Seminary.
But we're going to talk about what some of the critics have said about her research.
Yes. Olson goes on to say, quote, "As Pagel's comment indicates, the timing of the Nag Hammadi discovery was fortuitous for those wishing to interpret Jesus in their own image and destroy traditional Orthodox understanding of Christianity." End of quote. And then to prove his point, he quotes Philip Jenkins, whom we've quoted. We don't want to get too complicated with who we're quoting, but Jenkins, in his book, The Hidden Gospels, quote, "The Hidden Gospels have been used to provide scriptural warrant for sweeping new interpretations of Jesus, for interpreting theological statements in a purely symbolic and psychological sense, and for challenging dogmatic or legal rules on the basis of the believer's subjective moral sense. Generally, the hidden gospels offer wonderful news for liberals, feminists, and radicals within the churches who challenge what they view as outdated institutions and prejudices." End of quote. Later, when we discuss Gnosticism, we'll lay the Gnostic writings to rest by proving that the Christian Gnostics were heretics. And Gnosticism was not simply another valid version of Christianity.
Okay, so I think you mentioned before that many of these documents that have been rediscovered very recently, within perhaps the last 40 years or so, 50 years or so, have been known to exist in early Christianity, and the church found them to be not real accurate as to what we really, the people who were there, knew about Jesus and said about Jesus and wrote about Jesus.
Yeah, a lot of the early church fathers, they call them the heresiarchs, because they quoted such extensive quotations of these various heretics, such as Marcion and many, many others, Valentinian and others. And so that's all we knew about them was from these quotations. Now, some of these documents have been found in the 20th century, the actual documents.
Well, Ron, you've given us a wonderful presentation, but our time is running out. So we're going to have to come to a close, and we'll take up Gnostic Gospels as opposed to the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which the church has received from the very earliest times. May God bless you always and in all ways. Oh,